Welcome, everyone, to KDVS on a Wednesday afternoon at 5 o'clock. My name is Andy Jones, and this is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Very pleased that you've tuned in to your local campus and community radio station. Here on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour, I offer you interviews with some of the most fascinating people I can find in the worlds of creativity, theater, art, poetry, technology, including social media, website design, and all the other ways that technology, bits and bytes, and the variety of networks that we've so come to depend upon intersplice and interstice in such a way to give us a better understanding of what creative and critical thinking can do in this world. This afternoon on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour, I have Andy Smith. He's the co-author of The Dragonfly Effect, Quick, Effective, and Powerful Ways to Use Social Media to Drive Social Change. And then in the second half of the show, Joseph Hurtado. He is a Southside Hollywood-born poet, painter, and photographer who's going to talk to us about his new collection, When Life Refuses to Give You Up. So stick around. It's a great edition of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. As you probably know, if you're listening to this radio station, there are few places where you can find socially redeeming, authentic, and originally chosen programming on the radio these days. KDVS is one such place, for nobody tells us what to play. There's no payola here, no plugola. I book these guests that I have on my show myself, and I choose people who themselves are creative and original and authentic, often to talk about their books, but sometimes just to talk about projects that they've just begun to work on. My first guest this afternoon is Andy Smith, and he, along with his wife, Jennifer Aker, is the co-author of The Dragonfly Effect, Quick, Effective, and Powerful Ways to Use Social Media to Drive Social Change. Regular listeners know that we talk a lot about the arts as a way of expanding one's empathies, and making it more likely that one can connect with a larger community, as well as having a better understanding of where exactly we find worth and meaning in this life. So that's one of the ways that we will dovetail a little bit with Andy Smith's focus on social change. But as you'll hear from his biography now, he has a great number of interests and some impressive qualifications. Andy Smith is a principal of Vona Vona Ventures, where he advises a variety of companies on marketing, customer strategy, and operations. Over the past 20 years, he has served as an executive leading teams at places such as Dolby Labs, Big Words, Intel, Analysis Group, Polaroid, and PricewaterhouseCoopers. As a guest lecturer at Stanford's Graduate School of Business, Andy Smith speaks on social technology, engineering virality, and brand building, with a focus on applying technology to address real problems. This is one of the areas of focus of his new book. He's the co-author of The Dragonfly Effect, Quick, Effective, and Powerful Ways to Use Social Media to Drive Social Change. In this book, Andy and his co-author, Jennifer Aker, a social psychologist and business school professor, show how to tap the power of social media in order to achieve social change and have a real impact on the world. It's filled with examples of people and organizations that have successfully done so, whether the goal was finding an almost impossible bone marrow match for a friend, raising millions for cancer research, organizing a protest against the Revolutionary Armed Forces in Colombia, or electing the current president of the United States. Based on Aker's popular course at the Stanford Graduate School of Business, this book, The Dragonfly Effect, touches on diverse subjects, including the dark side of social technology, the mistake that nonprofits make in their social media outreach, and the concept of emotional contagion and how it can be spread via social media. Well, as a poet, I always welcome the chance to talk to someone who is socially aware and empathic and has explored these topics in a technological context, and such is the case with my first guest, Andy Smith. Welcome to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.
It's wonderful to be here, Dr. Andy. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Well, it's a really great book that you and Jennifer Aker have written, The Dragonfly Effect. As I was reading the copy that your publicist sent me and also looking for you here and there, I noticed that what popped up in my Google reader feed, but Chris Brogan doing a video review of your book. He liked it very much, and people who regularly listen to the show know that I've talked about Chris Brogan in the past. He says about the Dragonfly Effect, there's theory and there's applied theory. The Dragonfly Effect brings us all the way from the science into the execution. To me, it's that last mile that most of us miss. With this, you can take your ideas all the way through the last mile. So that's certainly welcome praise to you. It must be very exciting to finally have all these ideas that you and Jennifer Aker have been wrestling with and trying to control and understand and share and put it together in this brand new book.
It really has been, and it's been really wonderful and gratifying and at the same time humbling to have people like Chris Brogan, who, you know, are the sort of the reigning kings of social media and how to do it right, you know, say such wonderful things. I mean, I think that the opportunity to write this book was just fantastic, and it was presented to us because Jennifer and I come from marketing from two very different angles. I come at it from the sort of the practitioner range. You know, as you read very kindly in my biography, I spent most of my career so far in marketing operations, dealing mostly with conventional marketing of technology products. And she comes at it from an academic perspective, really from a view on psychology and what matters to people and how are brands and emotions different across cultures and how does that impact our ability to persuade people and to understand them better. And the social media convergence was a unique opportunity for us to come together on this because it really is more about people. And at the same time, it's also about technology. And so we sort of, if you can imagine, sort of hands joining at that point, you know, that's where we came together on the Dragonfly Effect.
That's wonderful. And I certainly wish that more of the social media gurus and enthusiasts who I've had on the show over the years had at home someone who was helping them think about morals and different audiences and using social network to improve the world. Because I think that really encourages a kind of thoughtfulness, which in this very exciting time of social media marketing and really a superfluity of gurus on social media, it's great to have someone who can provide an academic and a thoughtful context for all the work that we do.
Absolutely, and I mean that's Jennifer's sort of abiding expertise, and she's amazing at it, and has done some remarkable original research that we actually incorporated into the book, as well as just things that she's done before. It also sort of taps as a marketer, I think that I come at this occasionally, if you're in marketing for long enough, you start to feel like you don't know what value you're adding towards the world, because right. There's a lot of dark views of marketing. In fact, we try to expose some of the things that can go wrong or that can be misused. But, when you think of an advertising person, you don't necessarily think about someone who is trying to help you. You think of someone who's trying to create demand for something you don't need. Now, having spent a career in that side of the world, I don't believe that, but I can believe in that perception. And I think that it's mostly when people misapply things. As you mentioned, social media gurus, the times that that's been used in connection with my name, I've really cringed, because that to me is a sort of a charlatan term. It sounds like someone who isn't it. There's that famous quote that says that the difference between a normal person and an expert is that the expert has just had an opportunity to make more mistakes than the rest of us.
Yeah.
And in social media, it's so new that no one's made all the mistakes, and the people that profess to know everything generally are coming at something from a position that's relatively indefensible. And the opportunity that we saw was that these tricks or these tactics that people have used in marketing for years, particularly in new areas of marketing that relate to either tricking people or playing on their dark side or their weak points, are effective once, maybe, but they aren't effective again. And and even then, they're not great. And so one of the things we found was that deep down, what people are really motivated for is a pursuit of happiness. And beneath that pursuit of happiness, perhaps better directed, is called a search for meaning.
Right.
And when you connect meaning with what you want people to do as a marketer or as someone who's driving to build a cause, that's where you get a sort of, that's where you get bedrock. That's where you get something that's repeatable, and something that is authentic, and something that people will spread. Because the issue with social media is you can't buy it. You have to have a great message in order for it to advance, or something that really, really, really touches people. Because it's either really funny, like the Old Spice guy, and really creative. But there are a lot of Old Spice guys that came around right after that, and they couldn't do the same thing. If you touch people, where meaning hits them, the creative matters a little bit less. It's more about the strength of the appeal and the resonance with the people you're talking to.
And that creates an interesting sort of meritocracy in this field, because people can increasingly recognize when a guru is bogus or when he is scamming someone, in part because there are a lot of citizen journalists who are going to tell those stories. And if it's a compelling narrative, then that very story, that exposure narrative, if you will be picked up and might go viral. And so it turns out that the people who work with integrity and who bring meaning and service and support to customers as well as to strangers through, say, blogging and tweeting and so forth, that it's those people who will rise to the top and be recognized as, I think, what we could call thought leaders in this field.
Absolutely. There's never been a better time for integrity, because, the fact is that, when no one can buy the media, that's a much more level playing field. And that if you've got an authentic and true message, you can get it out there. People will resonate with people. And if you're not telling the truth, that people are going to be attracted towards correcting you, and they're going to be on the same platform as they are. So it's a great time, and I think that the challenge that a lot of people are finding when they try to deploy social media or understand it is that it's not always in people's interest who sort of do get it to make it easy for other people to understand it, because they need to sort of perpetuate the idea that it's harder or more different or more complicated than it really is. One of the things we try to do in the book is to build parallels for people, whether they're coming at this from the nonprofit angle, the individual angle, or the for-profit businesses. You know, they probably understand elements of communication, either as individuals or as people like myself who used to buy a fair amount of media. You know, for instance, you know, as different as things are, you know, YouTube is really a little bit like TV. It's a very rich, emotionally engaging environment. Main thing is that, you know, the quality standards are all off and that you don't get people's attention for very long, and the maximum length of anything you can create there is probably about 5 minutes before people drop off.
Right.
That said, you know, you have to try to catch people in the first few seconds, and that you do that with sound, you do that with picture, you do that with people, and that, you know, it's an 80% the same environment, and that 20% makes a big difference, but it's not like apples and oranges.
Absolutely. Well, let's reorient our listeners. Thanks very much, everyone, for tuning in to KDVS. My guest this afternoon is Andy Smith. He is a principal at Vonovona Ventures, and more importantly in this context, the co-author of The Dragonfly Effect, Quick, Effective, and Powerful Ways to Use Social Media to Drive Social Change. Andy, let me ask you this question. We've talked about how there's a lot of energy, a lot of enthusiasm surrounding social media, but there was a time when people didn't quite yet understand Twitter or Facebook or even LinkedIn and the possibilities of using these as devices to get a kind of business message out. I'm wondering if you could tell the story of how you came to discover these tools, came to use these tools, and how your understanding of them has evolved to include some of the concepts that you present in The Dragonfly Effect.
I'd be happy to. And I would say that just to add to what you just said, I'd say that it's still pretty early days for most social media, or at least when you think about how quickly Facebook has emerged as the power that is. You know, if you look back even 3 or 4 years, MySpace was considered, you know, the bigger, more powerful network.
Right.
But to the point of origins, I'm sort of an unfair choice in the sense that I'm a super tech geek. I adopt everything well before it's practical, and generally when it's very painful to use. But I came across all this stuff. I came across Twitter when it first came out, and I spent a fair amount of time trying to figure out what it was for. But the thing that got our joint attention between Jennifer and myself was this story of one of her students, Robert Chatwani, who at the end of one of Jennifer's classes came back to Jennifer with sort of the what he learned to observe, you know, following one of her classes. And he told the story of his best friend who'd been diagnosed with AML, very aggressive form of leukemia, and how he'd used social technology to find him a bone marrow match when he faced a 1 in 20,000 chance of reaching one because of a rare blood group and because he was from South Asian descent, and that he took an extremely sophisticated approach that was a combination of business smarts, understanding of marketing, understanding of how people work, and an understanding of the nascent social media to get the message out, because he didn't have a lot of money. He was a guy in his early 30s. But he managed to mobilize literally thousands of people to come out and get into this registry. In the space of about 11 weeks, they got 24,000 people into a bone marrow registry without investing, you know, very much money at all, just by building websites, using blogging tools, sending emails to people, and tweeting and doing the social media thing. It was then that we realized that we had something that we needed to share. When you can do something like this with free tools, and you can actually literally save a life, make a perfect bone marrow match for someone who is otherwise dying, that was just the most meaningful thing to us. And the fact that it came with a lot of sort of business sensibility, not just sensibility about the technology or sensibility about what makes people give out of pity, but what makes people give out of shared beliefs and desires, and what's good, sort of just good progressive marketing and business.
There's also an enthusiasm about that story as it unfolds. In other words, the story that you just told, all the work that he did was a means towards an end, but it becomes an end in and of itself as well, because people are saying, you know, exactly what you just told us. Wow, here's this guy. He doesn't have any money. He's got this huge task. He's probably going to be helped in the end. But also the fringe benefit, of course, is that so many other potential sufferers will be helped by all this information being in a database. This is something that you talk about in Chapter 3 of your book, The Dragonfly Effect, where you're talking about engaging, and that is how to tell these stories, because that, too, has become an important tool of marketers, and that is that there's often the story of the company, but increasingly the story of the effort to try something new and unusual, such as the Old Spice guy, and to get the word out. You know, these things kind of take on a viral, you know, lives of their own. And then all of a sudden, the cool people are the people who know the story rather than the people who have bought, say, the latest hit single on the pop charts.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, one of the things that really came out of it was that, you know, there are four relatively simple steps that Robert followed and that we distilled into the framework for the Dragonfly Effect. And the first one is a focus. It's an idea that when you're faced with this situation, you know, your friend needs a bone marrow match, and you're not a doctor. What can you do? You're tempted to try to do a number of things. You know, some of them palliative, some of them just, you know, to make yourself feel busy. And in this case, his friends got together and said, what we can do is we can actually find a match. And what we can do is everything we can to literally just focus on saving his life. And so they established, you know, what that would take. They knew what the odds were. They turned that into a metric by which they measured their progress. You know, 20,000 people had to get into the registry of the right ethnic group in order to have it happen. They knew the time frame. And so they had a really clear battle plan, and that was their focus. And they didn't divert from it. They didn't allow people to give money instead of marrow, because the idea was that would let people off the hook. They wanted people to actually get into the bone marrow database, because that was the only shot at saving his life. And they moved from there to, okay, now that we've got our focus, how do we get people's attention? You know, how do we make people look? How do we take them and make this real to them in a way that gets them, yanks them away from what they're currently doing? And we call that wing of the dragonfly, grab attention. Once you've got people's attention, you've got to move them into what you were talking about, the engagement portion, which revolves around storytelling. You know, how do you move people from just merely knowing about something to actually caring and converting and doing something on your behalf, either clicking or buying or donating, and actually, you know, participating in your cause? And then when you take those people and break them down, say 20% of the people that you got through the engagement process really want to do more. They're amped up, they're revved up. That's when you move them into what we call take action. And that's where social media really comes in. That's the part where you redeploy all of the efforts, all the tools, all the things you've done, all the templates that you've deployed to get people into the database or into the system so far, and give them to these highly motivated people. And they become part of the campaign, and they take it up on your behalf. And that's exactly what Robert did, and that's how they held hundreds and hundreds of bone marrow drives throughout the country without them having to orchestrate them or control them, because they deployed them in sort of an open source framework with tools and templates to make it easy. All you had to do was say, I'm going to hold a bone marrow drive, and the rest was really point and click, search and replace.
That's wonderful. Well, if you're just joining us, Andy Smith is my guest. He and his co-author, Jennifer Aker, have written a book called The Dragonfly Effect, Quick, Effective, and Powerful Ways to Use Social Media to Drive Social Change. If you want to find out more, you can visit their website at dragonflyeffect.com. One thing, Andy, that Chris Brogan mentioned in his video review is that although there is a focus on driving social change in this book, he reminded his viewers online on YouTube that there are a great number of lessons that are applicable to all sorts of people, whether or not they have such high-minded urges or plans or objectives. And I think that's something that you investigate a little bit with this idea of crowdfunding for small businesses and the example of ProFounder. I'm wondering if you could tell that story and tell people what crowdfunding is.
Sure, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought that up, because one of the things we found with the Dragonfly model is that it's very useful to have the saving a life case to prove that to dispel any chatter that somehow social media can't do something important. But once you've knocked off that it can do something important, you have to look at how can it be integrated into business. Because our, again, I come at this from a business perspective first and foremost, saying I think business can do better. We shouldn't just leave doing good to nonprofits and charities. Everyone should be able to do better. And so one of the examples that you brought up, ProFounder, is a great example of that. ProFounder was started by Jessica Jackley, who also started Kiva.org, which probably you're familiar with, the microfinance organization that supports entrepreneurs in the developing world,
right,
with investments as small as $25. After she did that program, and that's been going great, she went off and said, one of the discussions she had in the process was, well, what do we, people are hurting here in America, and maybe it's not in the same way, but what can we do for people here? And this coincided with the financial collapse, which, though we think of it as a sort of a broad or a big bank issue, one of the real tragedies of the financial collapse is that basically loans to small business have all but gone away. And so you can have a good business and get struck with a setback like a flood or a fire and just have to go out of business. If you were a popular restaurant, for instance, and you're stuck with being closed because of something beyond your control, you have no access to capital to rebuild or to even pay your workers while you're away. So the opportunity for crowdfunding comes in both for dealing with these unforeseen challenges, as well as for providing good working capital for expansion. The idea is that much more money, something like $120 billion a year, much more than is actually put into venture capital each year, is actually going into companies from what they call friends and family, money from people who are close to organizations. But for the most part, small business doesn't have access to that money, generally because getting together any sort of sophisticated equity investment is a very expensive proposition involving a lot of attorneys. So what ProFounder does is it takes the Kiva model and allows people to solicit people to invest in their small business and puts together a similar pitch saying, I'm Joe's Pizza. I want to, build a new location. I'm looking to raise $50,000 and put that out to their trusted friends network. People can come in and contribute and to loan money in the same way they do with Kiva and get a return paid back as a percentage of revenue over time. There's an additional option where people can actually take their interest or their excess returns over their capital investment and invest it in an entrepreneur's fund that is more of a nonprofit vehicle. So ProFounder is in the early stages, but it's already done its first few financings, and it's been really inspiring for us to participate in and to see, just because we believe that, I in particular believe that, small business, particularly Main Street business, is got to recover in order for, our country to become healthy again. And I'd like it to see it, happen as a matter of bootstraps, not just as, the government coming in and helping everybody out.
I think that makes a lot of sense. And what that also does is it rewards the sort of ingenuity, creativity, critical thinking, and entrepreneurialism that you've been describing, which gives me hope for instance, the students who I teach in my business and technical writing classes here at UC Davis, that they are, if you will, social networking natives. And so they understand how a lot of these ideas work because it's the really fabric of how they communicate with their peer groups. So when they come out into the world, I'm hoping that they can take a lot of that, those ways of thinking, those ways of solving problems that have become customary to them as students working in groups and working in networks of people they know and people they know only digitally, and harness the power of those networks to solve problems not only that are immediate and academic, but that may be, financial or creative or artsy or organizational or, the broad range of organizations that you talk about in the Dragonfly Effect.
Well, I have every hope that, I think we referred to the last generation or the group that came out 10 years ago as the digital natives, and I guess now we're dealing with like the social network natives. And it was a great opportunity to be able to write this and to be able to partner with companies like ProFounder, because I think it does put traction on some of these tools that have been available and fun and valuable, but have been difficult for people to really turn into productivity unless you were Google or Facebook. Now I think we're getting some more of these things in the hands of individuals where people can actually participate with their friends and their trusted networks to have careers and to do things better.
Absolutely. Well, if you're just joining us, Andy Smith is my guest, and he, along with his co-author, Jennifer Aker, have written a book called The Dragonfly Effect. We've been talking about some of the ideas found therein, but not all of them. If you want to find out about emotional contagion, if you want to find out about design thinking, as well as some of the other concepts that I know that Jennifer Aker has brought up in her Stanford Business School classes, then the name of the book and the name of the website is The Dragonfly Effect. It's dragonflyeffect.com. Let me ask you one last question, Andy Smith. In terms of creativity in your own life, whether it's as a consumer or as a producer, I don't know enough about you to know if you're a musician or an artist or a poet. What sort of ways do you dabble in this world of creativity that we're finding to be so important for, even if it's just providing the energy of the entrepreneurs who are upstart success stories in this world of social media?
Well, I guess I consider myself sort of a writer. When Jennifer and I wrote this book, I had the most fun with that than I've had in a long time. Just being able to, as a business person or as a marketer, sometimes you create in very short form snarky things. It was nice to actually make a real argument. So I consider writing to be a great creative pursuit. In the process of working on the book and working on the counterparts of the book, which is the website and the community that we built on Ning that complements it, because this is an organic thing. It's a little bit strange to write a book about social networking, because a book is necessarily static, whereas the experience is necessarily dynamic and continuing to grow. So I've spent a lot of time developing our web presence and thinking about how do we match the experience and principles of the book in an online environment and in a way that's really true to the dynamism of the book and the ideas and the examples that come out of it. So those have been my two areas. I think that fortunately my sons have got the creative talent. One plays guitar and one plays piano, and about the best I can do is join them for a session in rock band, but that isn't the real instrument.
Well, then they can entertain you, at least provide background music while you continue to hammer out those chapters of the sequels to The Dragonfly Effect. Could you remind me of the website for your book, and also what sort of things people will find there?
Sure. So the website is dragonflyeffect.com, and the kinds of things you can find there are both current blog posts that relate to current events, excerpts from the book, resources, and we've got a complimentary Ning community based on the social networking technology that the company Ning provides, where we actually have an interactive forum where people are sharing their own projects in process, sharing templates and tools, and trying to replicate as much as possible the projects that we profile in the book in a way that allows people to share the benefit of collective knowledge.
Excellent. Well, good. I look forward to spending some more time on the website, and I've really enjoyed the book itself. It's called The Dragonfly Effect, and Andy Smith is the co-author, along with Jennifer Aker, and they had some help as well from Carlisle Adler. Andy, it's been a pleasure to meet you on the radio.
Likewise, Dr. Andy.
Good work on this book, and I look forward to seeing its sequel or where, what sort of projects you and Jennifer take on next.
Fantastic. Thank you very much.
Good to meet you. Take care now.
Good to meet you, too. Take care.
Ladies and gentlemen, you're listening to KDVS 90.3 FM in Davis. My name is Dr. Andy. This is my radio show every Wednesday from 5 to 6. You can find me right here interviewing fascinating guests and poets. Poets such as Joseph Hurtado, who's here in the studio and soon will join me live on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Stick around for more jazz by Art Farmer. He said optimistically, having pressed a button. Everyone's enjoying the dead air on KDVS as the CD player jumps into action.
Linux Users Group of Davis, or LUGOD, is a nonprofit organization dedicated to promoting the Linux computer operating system and other open source products as an alternative to expensive, proprietary, and monopolistic software. LUGOD meets in Davis on the first Tuesday and third Monday of each month. For more information, visit LUGOD's website at lugod.org or contact Bill Kendrick at 530-759-1019. Or via email at root@lugod.org.
To Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour, and thanks to my first guest, Andy Smith. Joseph Hurtado is here in the studio with me at KDBS. He's a recent performer at the Davis Beat and Jazz Festival. Joseph Hurtado is a Southside Hollywood-born poet, painter, and photographer. He's traveled the U.S. extensively and is currently preparing for an extensive trip as an artist to Colombia and Spain to attend poetry festivals and art schools in Medellin, Madrid, and Barcelona. He's also in the process of going to print with his latest collection of prose and poetry, When Life Refuses to Give You Up. I heard his poetry at the Jack Kerouac Prize presentations, part of the Davis Beat Jazz Festival a few weeks ago. Really enjoyed his work, and I'm glad that he could come across the causeway to join us here today on Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Joseph Hurtado, welcome to the program.
All right, thank you, Andy.
Absolutely. Was I right in remembering that you were coming across the causeway, or are you coming from another direction?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah.
And to what extent these days, I know you're a world traveler, but to what extent do you think of yourself as a Sacramento poet?
Well, I've been here for a small number of years wanting to establish myself as, and if the question is how well am I known,
or what do you think of, how do you define yourself? In other words, does Sacramento, the place, or you know, the literary places, the musical places, the sights, the sounds, the the climate? To what extent do these come up in your poetry, and have they helped to define these years that you've been a Sacramento area?
Oh, I see, for sure. The seasons do help. I've put more things from my past into the words that I've written nowadays. I was able to catch a few glimpses of what I thought Sacramento was sort of like, and I put them to a few pieces, no doubt, that sort of highlighted some of the groups, some of the cliques, and some of the fashion that's going on here.
When you think of your poetry, or you find yourself sitting down to write a poem, what are the voices or the rhythms that you hear behind you? Is it voices of poets who you've admired or emulated, or are they musical rhythms, or are they traffic rhythms? What sort of things do you hear when you sit down to write something?
Right. It's primarily the sounds and the blurring noises and the flashing lights of the streets. Side alleys or side street alleyways. The urban life in general, honestly. I mean, I can't really sit to write a piece with anyone in particular in mind. Sometimes a little bit of jazz kind of, you know, is pretty cool, but otherwise it's just really everything urban, everything street.
Right.
Yeah.
What neighborhood of Sacramento do you call home?
Oh, I'm there at Midtown.
Yeah. That's where I lived all the years that I was in Sacramento. I wrote lots of my dissertation at the Weatherstone Cafe.
Very cool place. Yeah.
And there are times that I miss it. I think we made the right decision to come raise some kids here in Davis. But there's a lot going on in terms of music and art, and from my perspective, poetry, with a vibrant Sacramento Poetry Center. There are a lot of places one can go to get inspiration for a piece of poetry.
Oh, that's so true. I think almost at every block, every other block, there's something happening in regards to poetry. Whether it be from like the rhythmic slam to the up and downs of like open mics,
right?
And even also the more established poets come out every so often to some of the smaller bookstores.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, I bet people at home would like to hear a poem by Joseph Hurtado. What is the first work that you'd like to share this afternoon?
Oh, for sure. I thought that I'd just go ahead and read the one presented over at the Kerouac Festival.
Excellent.
Yeah, for sure.
Great, let's hear it.
All right, well, this one's called Streetlenders. It was written in a time when I was living in downtown L.A. and thought to sort of, grab that image and throw it into words. So, street vendors. Street vendors whistling on the girls in the tight jeans whose hips sway through in the swing. On the 80s wash of blue bottom and white crush top, the girls get pushed a bit to the smile, cornered on the quick. In the jewelry district in the grid where the gold swings and the platinum blings. The vendors sitting side by side, sweating out the day. One onto the other, together in the green can newsstand. Sellers in tight pants, belly overhang, bent on stools too small, behind sweated magazines and claiming their corners. The paired grosseros remain behind the clip curtain of magazines like Oi and Vivo, Todo Anal, and the Spanish-written Archie comic strips, while others stand beside their piece of green America. The stands are no more than a sweat can with two barn doors, their merchandise, a cheap-to-color print consortium. Mags are yellowed even before hitting the streets. The candies are secondhand, the gum too hard to chew, and the cigarettes are carried over the borders to circumvent the California tax. It's a fold-out business, 4x6x3, length by height by depth, tight and two men, shoulder to shoulder, sweating out on the rub. The day keeps at a slow pay. So while on 7th and Broadway, cheap lips smacking air kisses, and street smooth eye winks step out, a thin Luis finds easy. He charges towards you in a toothy smile, ostrich boots and a buckle from Juarez. He finds himself above the standard, you know, at 5'2", but with a 6-foot walk. He makes his mark of sales and continues. He sometimes finger snaps. Tourists get drawn in, then repulsed by the panting and wet tongue on a wife's arm, the tug on a girlfriend's hand. I don't say hi, but like a veterano, my back remains against the wall from 3 hours of walk. Like sweaty burgers and a bottled Coke. And the hundreds on the pass, but none that notice. They know the blocks ahead and have memorized the street blocks behind. Their heads stiff against the sidewalks, they walk. I cross out and head out, eyes looking forward and not on the down tilt, but sometimes on a side scene with mental notes and photo speech. I was born to the city, and now that it sleeps, I feel there's less room to stretch out my thoughts. My head, here goes on the down tilt, eyes to the back sounds, cracking from one to the other in a tunnel of near twin towers, restless, awake, crouching and stealing each minute.
That's wonderful. We were just hearing the poetry of Joseph Hurtado. Tell me again the title of that piece, Joseph.
Sure, it's the Street Vendors.
Street Vendors. I love the way that your poetry provides such a cascade of fresh images. And it's something I talk to my students about, that at a very basic level, if they can stop using the language that they hear all the time in conversation or that they hear in their simplest pop songs and try to do something original, then that's a big step. But and you do that marvelously while also presenting narratives and characters and settings and provide a really nice momentum to the poetry. That's delightful to listen to.
Yeah, see, and what's funny about that, honestly, is I don't think I'm quite witty or smart enough to actually think to come up with some kind of like a script, you know?
Right.
And out of sheer, like, happenstance, you get something like this coming out.
Well, yeah. There must be a little bit of crossing out lines that don't work or that don't ring true as well.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a quick musical break, and then we're going to hear another public service announcement, and then some more poetry. With my guest this afternoon on KDBS, his name is Joseph Hurtado, and you're listening to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Thank you.
Easy. Everyone would do it. It takes a special person to join the National MS Society's Bike Tours to Fight MS. If you like a challenge and want to have some fun for a good cause, call 1-800-FIGHT-MS.
Welcome back, everyone, to Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour on KDVS. I'd like to remind you that the Yolo County Central Landfill has a new program that helps reduce waste going into landfills. Residents of Yolo County, including UC Davis students, can now recycle techno trash, such as VHS and cassette tapes, CDs, DVDs, and floppy disks, at the Yolo County Central Landfill, free of charge. The landfill will also take your TVs, computer monitors, CPUs, electronic items, etc. If you want to find out more, go to YoloCounty.org. I'm here in the KDVS studios with Joseph Hurtado. He's a Sacramento-based poet, though also an itinerant poet. He's about to head off to South America and Europe to share his poetry and to see what he can discover. Right now, though, he's in the studios of 14 Lower Freeborn here at KDVS. He's brought some of his poetry to share with you all. What's the next poet that you've chosen, Joseph, or the next poem?
Hey, Andy. I've got a, it's one of a four-part prose that that I'd love to share for sure.
Great.
This one's titled Christmas Island. It's also a little bit of a glimpse, and also written here and by Sacramento. So again, Christmas Island. Christmas called, but I wasn't home. So the new year failed to wake. So it slept through spring and drank summer away. And the rush from all the idle play and the clouds never came. And the showers then fell silent to the not ground of sky and our feet that never swam on the asphalt, but rustled the rusted leaves aside, mixed in the southern breeze. And the tickled play of falling acrobats tumbled in pushers from behind the parks, from that jagged alley that pricks our bricks, for those benches that lean forward that we press close. And the warmth never comes, but remains free from our hands, that forget that can't be reached, that can't be lost, but stages the dramatic scene for you, of me and him, and here is where the park recedes away, to lean against the railway tracks, to rush away in the long mile, the haunt that stands in a stiff shock but we get ushered heavenward, and we get misplaced in the shuffle, and we shuffle back, the misplaced junk and the junk alone to cook for two, storms inward, the deep hand pulling out our collars, rushing with dinner set, we roll up the dice. Only now are our eyes licked wet. In the end, in the dark summer sun, on the black sand bridges and the ivory kiss, we ride out on the long stretch.
That's great. And the title of that one again?
That again is called Christmas Island.
Christmas Island.
Yeah.
I have a friend from Arizona who's recently moved to Boise, Utah, who spoke in his blog of Davis, California as Christmas Island because it seemed like an unreal place.
People
were unnaturally nice, and it made him a little uncomfortable.
Oh, well, you know, it's kind of, it's true. I'll have to admit that for sure. When I first came into SAC to Midtown, yeah, it's a good thing. I mean, actually, you walk down the street and here everyone is quick to say hi or, you know, how you doing? For sure. Yeah, most places I've been, they're pretty shy about that, I guess.
What I found is that when I travel now, and I guess this means mostly Washington, D.C., I make a point of greeting people I encounter on the street because, A, what have I got to lose? And I guess one feels less embarrassed when one is surrounded by strangers because nobody knows quite how goofy you're being. Nah, I guess part of that is my trying to bring some of the California attitude back east, where I was born and raised.
Which, yeah, absolutely, which I love. Yeah, it's a cool thing, no doubt, to get yourself out and just kind of, just kind of say hi to all those that you pass by, no doubt.
Absolutely.
It is.
We've got just a couple minutes left, but I wanted to hear just a little bit about your upcoming trip. I read earlier in your bio that you're going to be attending some poetry festivals and art schools. Which leg of that trip are you most looking forward to?
You know, actually, in truth, really both, honestly, because the first is going to be poetry focused,
right?
And on the second, which will be Madrid, Barcelona. That's going to be really working more on the photography and painting side of things. So generally when I'm writing, I've got the other two on the back burner. And then once, you know, things kind of stop developing on the poetry, yeah, then that's where I kind of utilize the painting. And then from there, right.
It's great to have all that to turn to, and I'm sure it makes writer's block much less of a concern because you've always got something creative going on.
Yeah, it creates a whole another dynamic, which is originally the reason why I decided to jump into art, was to sort of enhance the language of expression, I guess you could say, you know,
right.
Whether it be through the study of color or what have you, no doubt, and then photography just kind of came along with always being on the streets.
Yeah. Great. Well, Joseph Hurtado, it's been a pleasure to have you on the radio show, and I hope you'll drop me a line when you come back from all of your travels, and we can hear some more of the internationally inspired works that you could share with listeners.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you again, Andy, for having me now.
Absolutely. Well, folks, thanks to all of you for listening to this edition of Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour. Thanks to Andy Smith, who joined us first. He is a principal at Vona Vona Ventures, and he's the author of that new book called The Dragonfly Effect, Quick, Effective, and Powerful Ways to Use Social Media to Drive Social Change. And thanks also to Joseph Hurtado. He is a Sacramento-based poet, and we just got to enjoy some of his works. Stick around for some great music. Jess is here, and we'll be back next week for another edition of everybody's favorite poetry and technology program. This is Dr. Andy's Poetry and Technology Hour.